Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. It's Wednesday, March 11th, and this is our last lecture on muscles, and it's also the last lecture before your next test. And so let's take a look at the schedule, just to be sure we're on track. Make sure I'm right with you guys. The schedule. Schedule is going to appear. Okay, it's on the right hand side. Down on the bottom. Indeed, March 11th. I'm going to be done with muscles today. I'm going to go back and just talk about a couple things in the previous chapter, the neuromuscular junction. And then we're going to move on to the next chapter, and I'm going to show you some good internet resources for you to practice origins, insertions, and actions. And since it's the internet, I would expect to see some actions, right? Because we can use video players and flash players and things like that. All right, on the test next time, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. 7, axial skeleton, 8, appendicular skeleton joints, 9, skeletal muscle tissue, which is 10, and then some muscles of the body, that's 11. All right, so I've had a number of questions. What origins and insertions do I have to know for the lecture exam? All right, it's really easy for the practicum because the muscles are listed specifically for you. There's tables that you fill in, right, if you have to know the origin insertion, and if there's an NR in one of the cells of those tables, then you're not responsible for knowing that bit of information, that bit of knowledge for that particular muscle. All right, but for the lecture exam, if an origin and insertion is ever mentioned in the pre-lecture reading assignment, you should know that one. If it was ever mentioned in your lecture notes, like I had a couple in the lecture notes, like sternocleidomastoid, occipital frontalis, biceps, triceps, those you should know. And if there's any that are mentioned in the study guide, for instance, at the end of the chapter, if there's a question about origin insertion there, you should know, or any of the online practice questions. And you know which online practice questions to study because they're in the study guide. All right, so to partially answer your question is, know the origins and insertions that are included in the study guide. But what's not listed in the study guide is the lecture notes, and you should just know that, and also the pre-lecture reading assignment. And I think that covers everything, okay, of the ones that you have to know. So in the study guide and online, it tells you the page numbers that you have to read for this chapter, and there are probably hundreds and hundreds of origins and insertions that are included in all those pages. Well, indeed, you do have to read those pages, but you don't have to memorize all the origins and insertions in that group of pages. Okay? All right, so what else do you need for the exam? You need your picture ID. Please don't come without a picture ID. You need an 882E Scantron, a good pencil, and a really good eraser. And the picture photo ID. Oh, yeah, you mentioned that. Don't forget that one. Mention it twice. And that's it. Don't need a calculator or any other thing. And make sure all your cell phones are off during the test. Okay, anybody got a question on the test or the schedule? No? Okay, fantastic. So I'm going to put that away. And I'm going to go back and talk about something. We looked at this slide before. Okay, and we talked about excitation-contraction coupling. And we looked at these all the different structures. So I see mitochondria, that's a good thing to recognize right away, right, that makes ATP. I see the cell membrane, and for a skeletal muscle cell, the cell membrane is called the sarcolemma. And inside the cell, besides mitochondria as organelles, there's another organelle that's specialized for contraction. Then what is the name of that organelle? I see it right here. Not where the cursor is, because that's on a mitochondria, of course. But I see the organelle responsible for contraction. And we've got to know the name. Okay? I see sarcoplasmic reticulum here, for sure, that's an organelle, but the job of sarcoplasmic reticulum is to store calcium ions and release them into that organelle for contraction. The organelle for contraction is the cylinder. This is what we call the myofibril. Okay, so be sure you can go up and down that level of hierarchical level of organization in a muscle. I think we should do that. Maybe we should do that right now. Right, if we have a whole big muscle like the biceps, right, and we do a nice transverse section of that biceps, we're going to see some structure. What do you need to put together to make a whole muscle like a biceps? Yeah, you need fascicles, right? You need fascicles. And in order to make a fascicle, you need to put something else together. What do you need to put together to make a fascicle? Muscle fiber. What's another name for muscle fiber? Muscle cells. Exactly the same thing. We call it a fiber, right, because it's composed of many cells that have fused together. So a muscle fiber is very long and narrow, and it's loaded with nuclei from all those cells that join together. All right, so that's how we make a muscle cell or a muscle fiber. And how do we make a muscle cell? What's a building block of a muscle cell? Myofibril. That's the answer I was looking for. That's the organelle for contraction. So if we put a bunch of myofibrils together, then we get a muscle fiber. Right? Fibrils added make a fiber. And but let's just keep going for just a little bit. And if you look at it, so here are the myofibrils. You see these cylinders inside the cell? So I see a myofibril here and here, here and here. And of course, when we look at a myofibril, we see additional structures. Right? How do we make a myofibril? What do we put together? A couple proteins. Myofilaments, that's right. And what kind of myofilaments are you aware of? Actin and myosin, right? Which one's a thick one? Which one's a thin one? And you understand the association between actin and myosin? They're responsible for contraction. So which one of those shorten? Neither. What do? They slide over each other, right? And I showed you a video last time of the cross bridges pulling right on the actin molecule. Remember, you should also know something about a sarcomere. And I see half of a sarcomere. Oh, no, here's a whole sarcomere right here. The ends of a sarcomere are what we call the Z-discs. And either actin or myosin is going to be attached to the Z-disc. Which one of those is attached? This is not a trick question. Actin, yeah, actin is attached. Myosin is in the middle, right? So that when there's overlap between actin and myosin and there's ATP and there's a calcium ion signal floating around inside the sarcomere, then those cross bridges between myosin and actin will operate and will pull on the actin molecule, bringing the Z-disc closer to the midline of the sarcomere, on both ends of the sarcomere. And so the sarcomere is going to shorten. And remember the light bands, we call the I bands. And when the sarcomere shortens, what happens to the I bands? They shrink or they shorten as well, right? And then there is this H zone. In the H zone, you only have myosin filaments. You don't have any actin. So that's a dark area because it has myosin, but it's not as dark as the area over here that has overlap between actin and myosin. So that's kind of a gray area. What happens to this gray area during contraction? It shortens or disappears as well. So I think there's sort of a trick question in the online questions that I asked you. I asked you, what shortens in a sarcomere when it contracts? And I kind of beat it into you saying, well, actin and myosin don't shorten. So your first idea is, well, nothing shortens. Okay, but if that was true, then muscle wouldn't contract. Something's got to shorten, right? And so what is that that shortens? It is this I band shortens or disappears, number one. The H zone disappears or shortens, right? And but what's the whole point of this? What shortens? This whole sarcomere shortens, right? Okay, so those are three things you should know about. All right, so make sure you know something about this sarcomere because it is the structural and functional unit of contraction. If you know about this sarcomere that you're looking at right here, you know how all skeletal muscle works and to a large degree all cardiac muscle and in a sense even how smooth muscle works. And we can see that from each of these myofibrils, the sarcomeres line up exactly, and that's why skeletal muscle is when you look at skeletal muscle, it looks striated. Yeah, it produces those striations that are easy to see. All right, so don't forget, the organelle-4 contraction is a myofibril made up of myofilaments, right? And that energy comes from this ATP. The other thing that I notice on this slide is that these myofibrils are deep inside the cell, and they have to be excited into contraction. The signal for, or the excitation signal, is a something that looks a lot like a nerve impulse. It's an electrical signal that runs along the surface of the cell. Okay? And so how does that electrical signal get deep inside the cell where all these myofibrils are located? Ah, look at this. The electrical impulse runs down over here, and then when it gets to this orifice of a T-tubule, it will follow the T-tubule deep inside the cell. Right? And so now that electrical impulse is not only on the surface of the cell, it's deep inside the cell, and it is in through that T-tubule. The T-tubule is associated with sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's a smooth kind, so it's not responsible for protein synthesis. Right? It's not rough, it's smooth. And in skeletal muscle, what's the prime function of smooth ER? It stores calcium. And when that electrical impulse comes through the T-tubule, it causes the smooth ER to release calcium into the myofibril, and that's the signal for contraction. That's what allows myosin to attach to actin and pull, and that allows myosin to pull actin closer to the midline. And as that calcium disappears inside the myofibril, tell me what happens. This calcium is actually grabbed by the sarcoplasmic reticulum and put back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. We say it's actually pumped out of the myofibril and put back into the reservoir. What happens to the myofibril then? We said calcium is the signal for contraction. If the signal disappears, the muscle relaxes, yeah, and the sarcomere goes back to its original length, because remember, muscles have elasticity associated with them. Okay, so I want to complete this thought a little bit by looking at another figure in your textbook, which kind of shows this in another light, right? And it's just this one right over here. Maybe I'll go back one slide. All right, so do you see a muscle fiber here? Here's the muscle fiber, right? It's striated, so what kind of muscle does this look like? It's unbranched, skeletal muscle. It's multinucleated, so again, that's a skeletal muscle. On the inside, what do I see? Myofibrils, right? And I see all these sarcomeres. All right, so how is this muscle excited? Well, it's excited by a neuron. All right, so here's part of the nervous system. We haven't talked about this just yet. But a nerve will go all the way down to this muscle, and it will tell this muscle to contract. How is this possible? Well, because there's a special junction between the neuron and the muscle cell, and it's called the neuromuscular junction. It's a special kind of communication between these two cells. We call this a synapse. Have I ever mentioned a synapse in here before? I don't believe so. I can't remember doing it. So here is an example of a synapse. So synapse is the structural and functional unit of communication between cells. What's the structural and functional unit of life? Cell. What's the structural and functional unit of contraction? I would like for you to know sarcomere. Sarcomere, and you put a bunch of sarcomeres together, you do get a myofibril. What's the structural and functional unit of communication between cells? This synapse right here. So let's look in detail at this neuromuscular junction. So here is the tip of a neuron. So this is what we call an axon, bringing information away from the cell body. That electrical signal gets to the tip, and notice that the tip is a little swollen right here because there's a lot of special organelles. And sometimes people call this little swelling at the end of an axon a button or terminal button or a Bouton terminale, or a Bouton, or a synaptic knob. It runs around with a whole bunch of different names. That's just how anatomy goes sometimes, right? Because I know you all have different names too. All right, so here is that Bouton terminale, or synaptic button, which is on a neuron. So what comes down from the cell body, from the major part of the cell, down the axon? What kind of event is traveling along a neuron? It's an electrical event. That's what I want you to think about. an electrical event. And when that electrical event gets down to this terminal button, right, it's going to activate all of these vesicles that are filled with a chemical called a neurotransmitter. When the electrical signal comes down, this vesicle moves over to the cell membrane of the neuron, fuses with the membrane, that neurotransmitter is secreted into the space between the neuron and the muscle cell. It will diffuse from high concentration to low, from an area close to the neuron to an area that's very close to the muscle cell. And that neurotransmitter then binds the special proteins on the membrane of the cell, of the muscle cell, and that causes another electrical signal to develop on this muscle cell membrane, the sarcolemma. So, all right, so this is the way that information is transmitted through a neuron. It's an electrical signal. Through this particular connection, the synapse, it is converted into a chemical signal. That chemical is a neurotransmitter. And then that neurotransmitter information is reconverted back into an electrical signal that flows over the surface of the muscle fiber. So probably what you're noticing is that neurons and muscle cells behave very similarly in terms of electrical impulses, and indeed they do. Right? There's a lot in common between a neuron and a muscle, but the muscle has one ability that the neuron doesn't have. What does a muscle cell have that a neuron doesn't have? What is a muscle cell specialized to do? Contract. That's right. A nerve cell cannot contract, but it can send electrical impulses, nerve impulses. Right? A muscle cell can transmit electrical impulses. We don't really want to call it a nerve impulse because a muscle cell is not a nerve. Right? But they're almost exactly the same kind of thing. And when that impulse travels over the surface of the membrane, it can hop a ride on this T-tubule, causing the sarcoplasmic reticulum to release calcium into the myofibrils, and then the sarcomeres within that myofibril contract. All right, so this combination of two terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum and one T-tubule, that is called a triad. And they've got to be very close to each other. They basically have to be touching each other. All right, so don't forget, you got an electrical signal, chemical signal, and then it's converted finally into an electrical signal on the surface of that muscle cell membrane or the sarcolemma. So this thing right here is what we call a synapse. And we have two cells. We have the presynaptic cell, which is the neuron, and we have the postsynaptic cell, which is the muscle. This is how we talk about cells involved with a synapse. And this particular one requires a chemical messenger to go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell. And so we call this kind of synapse a chemical synapse. When we get into the heart chapter, we're going to learn another kind of synapse that's called an electrical synapse. But most of the synapses in your body are a chemical synapse. So if you know how this synapse works, you pretty much know how all synapses in your body, or how cells communicate with each other, at least from a neuron to some kind of effector cell. All right, so here we see what kind of ion or electrolyte is necessary for muscle contraction. I see calcium right here. Right? Here's something else that's special about calcium. When the nerve impulse comes down to this terminal button, these vesicles know to move over to the cell membrane because something special happens. Calcium, again, is released into the interior of the neuron, and that causes the migration and fusing of these vesicles to the cell membrane, which then causes release of that neurotransmitter. Without calcium ions, right, these vesicles couldn't move over to the cell membrane, could not release neurotransmitter, right? And then basically the synapse would not work. So that's another important role for calcium. We call that synaptic transmission. Synaptic transmission is just the way that two cells communicate with each other, right? Between one neuron and a second neuron, or between a neuron and a muscle cell via this neuromuscular junction. All right, so what's a third place that you know calcium is important in your body? Bones, that's right. Well, as we get older and run out of calcium, you don't have enough calcium to go everywhere in your body unless you're really, really careful. Where would you choose to put calcium if you only have a limited amount and you can't just give everywhere in your body calcium when they require it? Would you put calcium in muscle so muscles can contract? Would you put it in neurons so neurons can communicate with each other? Or would you put calcium in bones so that bones are strong? Holy cow. I'm confused. I don't know what I would choose. And it's really sad. Your body has to make a choice. Well, okay, it sacrifices bones so that neurons can function, right, so that your brain can function, and also in muscles so that they can operate. And the last important place is your bones. And so that's why one of the reasons how we understand that really important disease process that makes our bones brittle as we get older, why it happens. What's the name of that disease process? Osteoporosis, that's right. So I would guess that you should be really interested, how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? How can you make sure that you have enough calcium in your body as you get older? What can you do? The reason why people really hate this class, it's not because you got to learn origins and insertions or a bunch of names of different muscles and things like that, but why do you hate this class? Because you learn what do you have to do to protect yourself from osteoporosis. Diet and exercise, right? Those two things. Well, it's really, really important. Exercise, weight-bearing exercise, lifting weights, running, something like that. Be active, right? And there are two components to diet. What are the two components that you have to have in your diet? Okay, well, for sure calcium, because that's what you want to get in, and vitamin D, because you need vitamin D in order to absorb the calcium that's in your diet, right? So diet and exercise, the kind of diet is reasonably high in calcium and vitamin D. Okay. All right, so calcium is very important for all kinds of processes. Now you know at least three things that's important. So here is a neuromuscular junction. And the space between the presynaptic and postsynaptic cell is called the synaptic cleft. And the electrical signal can't jump from the pre to the postsynaptic cell because it would have to jump across the synaptic cleft. And if it jumped across, then there would be something like a lightning bolt right there. And we don't have any lightning bolts like that in our body, right? So that signal has got to be converted into chemical to get across this space. Okay, so that is, what I'm looking at right here is just one muscle fiber. All right, so and this one muscle fiber will contract and all of the other neighboring muscle fibers will stay relaxed, right, if they don't get a signal from a neuron to contract. All right, so it is possible for just one cell in a whole big muscle to contract. Muscle spasms is when a whole muscle contracts. Right, all the muscle cells contract, the whole muscle goes into spasm. Right, so if you get a muscle spasm in your biceps, the whole biceps is going to contract. Okay, and there's a bunch of different reasons why that might be. Damage to that muscle, or maybe hydration levels, you're running low on water, which means then the concentration of these ions changes, and so there could be an electrolyte imbalance. Water imbalance kind of means the same thing. Okay. All right, well, what do I see right here? Well, I see this nice bone. I see connective tissue between the bone and muscle. You know what that's called? What is that called? That's a tendon. And I see a bunch of fascicles, right, that make up this muscle. And then I even see a muscle fiber, okay? And I see nice striations in it. I see myofibrils inside this fiber. So all of these tubes right here are muscle fibers or muscle cells. And here I see two different neurons going to this muscle, whatever it is. We could consider this the biceps brachii, for instance. And I can see that each of these nerves right here split. We call that bifurcate, right? And number one, which kind of looks blue to me, I see splits into two endings. And the one on the top, which kind of looks red to me, splits into three nerve endings. Right, so when a nerve impulse comes down motor unit number one, or neuron number one over here, this blue one, how many muscle fibers contract in this whole big muscle? How many muscles contract? Yeah, do you see that? You see two? Because this neuron goes to this fiber right here, and also this fiber right here. So when the nerve impulse comes down, only these two fibers contract. None of the other fibers contract. All right. All right, what about the red neuron? When a nerve impulse comes down, how many nerve fibers does it go to? Yeah, I see three. One, two, three. and none of the other surrounding nerve muscle fibers will contract if there's only a nerve impulse on this red neuron. Okay, so here is something that confused people for a long time. A muscle cell, like what I'm pointing to right here, will contract always to 100% of its ability, right? So it can't change the tension that it produces, right? It is always going to contract maximally if it's healthy, right? But you know that not to be true necessarily when you're considering a whole muscle, right? Because you can, if you're going to lift something up, you can use a lot of muscle to lift up something that's heavy, or if you're lifting up something that's really, really light, then you know that you don't contract that muscle as strenuously because whatever you're lifting up would just, you just throw it right over your head, right? You can decrease that force of contraction and lift something up nice and gently, whether it's heavy or if it's light. So that muscle can contract strongly or weakly. So how do we describe why a muscle cell will only contract strongly, but a whole muscle can contract strongly or weakly, depending on what it's asked to do? And that's where we invoke this understanding of a motor unit, right? So if you want to generate a weak contraction, right, which neuron would you send electrical impulses to? Okay, that's number two or number one? Do you see that number one will produce a less strong contraction, right? And motor unit number two will produce a stronger contraction because there's 50% more nerve fibers that are going to contract, right, even though this goes from two to three. Okay, so different motor units are excited depending on how much strength or how much force this muscle, this whole muscle right here, is asked to perform. And if you need a really strong contraction, then different motor units are activated. More motor units are activated. So instead of just two motor units, maybe three or four, or maybe all of the neurons going to a particular muscle are sending nerve impulses down to this muscle, like the biceps, so all of the muscle fibers contract all at one time. All right, so you can pick up a styrofoam ball nice and gently, just like you can pick up a bowling ball. And sometimes that produces kind of strange effects. Your previous experience will determine how many motor units are necessary to lift an object up. And let's just say we have a nice styrofoam ball. Is that heavy or light? It's very, very light. Let's paint it black or some kind of fancy pattern. Drill a couple holes in it so it looks exactly like a bowling ball. All right, so it's an exact replica of a bowling ball, but it's what? It is light instead of heavy. So if you walk up to that fake bowling ball, you think it is, and you grab it and you start to lift it, what's going to happen? Whoa, you're going to lift it up way over your head, right, because you had already thought that it's going to be a really heavy object. But fortunately, there are other parts of our nervous system that catch that error and you don't throw it someplace. Okay? And the way that we explain how that force can change is by motor unit. Different motor units are activated depending on the load that muscle is asked to perform, even though every single fiber, right, it contracts to its maximum no matter what. All right, so I want to go back to this slide. I said that there's neurotransmitter in this vesicle that's released when a nerve impulse comes down, calcium floods this Bouton terminale, the neurotransmitter is released. Where's the neurotransmitter released into? Yeah, synaptic cleft right over here, so that's some good anatomy. But I want to give you a name of a particular neurotransmitter. There are many neurotransmitters, but there is only one at all neuromuscular junctions. There's only one neurotransmitter that's used everywhere at synapses between neurons and muscles, and it is called acetylcholine. Right? And it's abbreviated, capital A, capital C, little h. That stands for acetylcholine. And that's a very important neurotransmitter in our body. It's used for other kinds of synapses, but it's noteworthy to know that all neuromuscular junctions use acetylcholine as its specific neurotransmitter. Okay, so now I think I'm done with this chapter, unless somebody has some questions. Yeah.
Regarding the receptor D, that
Oh, I tell you what, I can't quite hear. I hear some other talking over there.
And
okay, tell me where I should go to find that gate that you're thinking about. Oh, over here. Oh, this thing right here?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, let's zoom in. I'm going to zoom in, and then I'm going to ask you to tell me your question once again. Okay, I see the gate you're talking about.
Is that activated by the acetylcholine that continues through? Is there another
impulse? I see exactly what you're saying. I see exactly.
Okay,
so this little protein in the membrane of the muscle fiber, okay, is a special channel that will allow other ions to enter the muscle cell, not calcium, but sodium. This is kind of beyond the level of this class, but it's interesting to know. All right, so sodium ions are high on the outside, low on the inside. They're always trapped on the outside of the cell unless a pathway opens up between the outside and inside of the cell. That pathway is what we call a channel. Some channels are always open, some are open and then they can close, and some are closed and then they can open depending on the circumstance. Right? This kind of channel right here is what was asked. This is what we call a gated channel, so sometimes you might just want to call it a gate. Sometimes it's open, sometimes it's closed. And most of the time it is closed. Right? And that prevents sodium from entering the cell when it's closed. The only time it opens is when neurotransmitter moves across the synaptic cleft and binds to this protein in the cell membrane, and then the gate opens up, and then sodium can enter the cell. Just a lot like calcium entering the cell over here, but instead of calcium entering the cell, sodium enters. All right, and the entry of sodium into the muscle cell is partly responsible for making that electrical impulse that travels down the muscle cell. Same thing for a nerve impulse in a neuron. The cell membrane of a neuron has to have these channels that open up that allow sodium to enter, and then a nerve impulse can travel along a neuron as well. So this channel is closed until it binds to, unless it's bound to the neurotransmitter that's released from the presynaptic cell. Yeah. So I see some of that binding right here. And this is kind of a typical example of this kind of receptor. It's got to bind, you see it right here, two acetylcholines before it can open up and allow sodium to enter. Okay, so that's kind of beyond the scope of this class, but it kind of answers your question well enough.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, question. Okay. Calcium has to get into the axon terminal or the terminal button. Okay. And then that calcium causes the movement and fusion of this vesicle. All right. And it just so happens, all right, so we're talking about some electrolytes, some electrophysiology, which we're not really big on in this class, but it's really fascinating to know something about that. We talked about calcium as being an electrolyte. We just talked about sodium as being an electrolyte, how important they are. Sodium is always high outside the cell, low on the inside. The same for calcium. Calcium is always going to be high outside the cell, low inside the cell. So as soon as there's a pathway that opens up that will allow calcium to go through, it's going to move in by diffusion from high concentration to low concentration. The only thing that's under control is that gate when it opens and closes. Right? This one right here opens and closes depending on whether it binds to a chemical. This one over here opens or closes depending on the electrical environment that it's in. If there's an electrical impulse that comes down, then it opens up. All right, so these are two different kinds of channels. They're both gated, but they listen to different kinds of stimuli. Okay. So, okay. So those are all really good questions. I can see you guys are going to love physiology. Okay, anything else on this chapter? Pretty much you're good? Okay. All right, so you don't have to know where calcium is high, where sodium is high, or probably pretty much about anything about sodium or calcium, but those are important electrolytes in our body. Okay, so I'm going to close that figure down. Is there anything else I want to show you on this chapter? I think not. That is good. Okay. All right, so let's look at some muscles. Am I in the right chapter? No. This one. So we talked about naming some muscles last time, and we talked about one really good example, probably one of your favorite muscles, is the sternocleidomastoid, right? Because the origin and insertion are in the name of the muscle, so just by knowing the name of the muscle, then it's the answer key for knowing the origin and insertion. All right, so here's that sternocleidomastoid. You would have it on the other side, but it's taken away so that we can see some deeper muscles underneath it. I'm not concerned with these at the moment. Sternocleidomastoid, the first part of the word always refers to the origin. The second or last part of the word refers to the insertion. And remember, which end of the muscle produces more motion, origin or insertion? It's always going to be insertion. That's right. So when the sternocleidomastoid contracts, is it the clavicle and sternum that move, or is it the mastoid process that moves? Mastoid process, right? Because that you can understand that from the name. And indeed, we talked about when one sternocleidomastoid contracts, it causes a rotation and flexion of the cervical spine. If both contract, then it's just a pure flexion motion. It's not any kind of rotation. All right. Now, the important thing, I think, in this chapter to understand is that principle of antagonism. Right. So here we have a muscle. It's attached to the mastoid process. It's going to cause the mastoid process to move. And this is on what side of your body, anterior or posterior neck? Anterior, that's right. You can see, you can observe this muscle contracting in a lot of people. So where would you find a muscle that's antagonistic to the sternocleidomastoid? Opposite body compartment, so posterior neck. And then you just have to look in the posterior neck. Oh, and on the very next slide, right, I see the posterior aspect of the scapula and vertebral column. I see some muscles attached to the mastoid process, and what should you be thinking immediately? I found it. Okay. So here are some muscles on the posterior neck attached to the mastoid process. This muscle right here is antagonistic to the sternocleidomastoid. So always think opposite body compartment. All right. And there are a number of different kinds of splenius muscles, but in this class, I don't care that you know all the different names. You can call all of these what? Splenius, right? Splenius. Okay. And so you will learn a lot about antagonistic muscles by opposite body compartments. Here are another whole group of muscles, hundreds of muscles here. I want you to know all of these as the erector spinae. So if somebody points to a muscle in the back, what are you going to say? Erector spinae, if it's a deep muscle. There's some other muscles on top of these, like maybe trapezius up over here and latissimus dorsi. But these have to do with the vertebral column. And all of these are going to be erector spinae. These will straighten up the vertebral column from a flexed or leaning forward position to, okay, a straight up position. We call that extension. So these will extend the vertebral column. By definition, I'll tell you that. So where do we want to look for muscles that will flex the vertebral column? Opposite body compartment, right? And that's what we have right here. Right. So especially you could say that the rectus abdominis is one, but any of these muscles in the anterior abdomen will flex the vertebral column, right? Including these that are in a transverse plane. So this is what we call the transverse abdominis. Right, so here's rectus because it's just a straight. Here's transverse. Right, these are aligned very nicely with the imaging planes. But then here are a couple that are angulated. What do we call something that's angulated off a standard plane? Oblique. Right, so here are some oblique stomach muscles or abdominal muscles. There's one that's superficial. There's one that's deep. Right, so we have an external oblique and an internal oblique. And then we have this transverse. So you can see that the fascicle arrangement of these muscles right behind the rectus abdominis, right, don't always match up. As a matter of fact, there's a mismatch of the direction of fascicles. And that's very important because that's what gives the abdominal wall a lot of strength, right, when you have fascicles oriented in other different directions. Does anybody have an example that they could present to the class to where if you build something in layers, that if you put all the layers in different orientation, right, will make that object really strong. Like in, somebody pointed to the tabletop. For instance, if you have wood that's made up of different layers, they call that plywood. Wood has grain in it. And one reason why plywood is so strong is because when they glue all these layers together, the grain is oriented in different directions. The grain through plywood is not always the same, because if it was the same, then it could crack very easily. Right? So it's not as strong. Also, tires have belts in them, and those belts are arranged in different layers and different orientation to them, and so that helps maintain the integrity of a tire as well. All right, here we have an aponeurosis. Remember, an aponeurosis is a broad, flat, tendinous sheath. I see one here, and I see one here. The one on top of your head, that's an aponeurosis, but it's got a special name. Anybody remember the special name on the one on top of your head? That's called the Galea aponeurotica. Okay, I'm not exactly sure how it got its name like that. Okay. All right, so I want to show you a really good web resource. And we're going to look at, let me show you where I found it. So go into Blackboard, right, and then Weekly Assignments. Click in Weekly Assignments. And then you're going to pick the Muscle Week, which is activated for you guys. So Muscles of the Body, click on that. And then you're going to get into all these pages for week number 8. Did you guys do this one already? I think maybe you guys went through this. Way down here at the bottom, even past these practice quizzes, is a website called Get Body Smart. Get Body Smart you'll be visiting this site quite often. And here we have links to various parts of the body, muscles that act on the arm, shoulder, okay, muscles of facial expression. That's what you're doing in lab today. This particular one is not very extensive, facial expression. Hopefully somebody will program this and add some more muscles. But let's just link into this. And I linked into it, and for some reason I needed a plugin that Firefox didn't have, but my Internet Explorer did. I didn't have time to put it into Mozilla. So here is, so I'm using just a different browser, and of course you can have more than one browser open on your computer at one time, different browsers, that's no big deal. Alright, so what is interesting about this site right here? Well, I see a head. Alright, so we're looking at muscles of facial expression, so you can practice your anatomy. Where do we find all these particular muscles? And you can take the labels off, you can practice labeling, right? Or you can say, oh, I know what this one is, but that's one that you're not responsible for. Let's pick one that you are responsible for. How about this one right here? You should know what that is. Say it out loud, turn the labels on, orbicularis oculi. Did you say that? All right, extra credit, very good. Nice, so you can just practice all of your different muscles. Here's another orbicularis, you agree? Yeah, oris, right? So you can double check, and you got a lot of good muscles like mentalis, depressor labii inferioris, it's zygomaticus, right? But here is one. Okay, I see one belly of it. Here's that Galea aponeurotica, and here is the frontal belly of the occipital frontalis. Another name sometimes is called the frontalis, but remember that's connected to the occipitalis back on the occipital bone. And what can we do? I think we can get rid of some of these muscles, right? Just so that we can see certain ones attached to various bones. That's handy to understand something about origins and insertions. All right, so I got rid of, I basically just virtually dissected all these muscles away from the skull. We're left with, right, the frontalis, and it's pointing to the insertion and the origin. Right, and then over here you see origin and insertion, the text with it. Right, and then we have our, what do we call this guy over here? I don't want to call it a mannequin because a mannequin is a real thing. This is a, what do you call something in virtual space that's like a person? A what? Avatar, fantastic. Here's a little avatar, right? And this little avatar can go into motion and We're going to find out what the action of the occipital frontalis is. You know that it is supposed to elevate the eyebrows. Right? And so let's see if that happens. Raises eyebrows. Let's click on raises eyebrows and, did you see it or is it too small? Raises eyebrows. Or you can grab the slider, right, and really pay attention to what the motion is. Wrinkles the forehead. Okay, grab the slider. Does it produce wrinkles on the forehead? Exactly. All right, so here's a way that you can visualize the actions of muscles. And when you visualize, it probably will help your, another way that will help your understanding and memorization of what these muscles do. Okay. All right, so for sure, I would want you to use this to understand something about antagonistic muscles. So I'm not going to go back to Blackboard. Let's see what happens when I go home in this website. I got skeletal system, muscle, tissue, nervous system, right? A lot of good things that you might want to look at, but let's just look at muscle system. And then we can pick what area we want to work on, and let's just say muscles that act on the arm. I like that, right? So here we have some muscles. Deltoid, right? You should know where it is. Here it is on the top of the shoulder, the acromial region of the shoulder. And if you want to know something about the deltoid, just click into it, right? And it will load everything up. It will put all those muscles together. But you might want to just focus on where the deltoid is, right? So you can put all the muscles back and then take some away and just leave yourself with the deltoid right there. And, okay, and if you click on origins and insertions, right, then they pop up. That will help you understand origins and insertion. Of course, here's the more movable end. Does anybody know this part on the humerus? What's this little part where the deltoid inserts? Deltoid tuberosity. That's something that you had to know. So this deltoid tuberosity is going to be pulled toward the acromion, right, or the clavicle right here. So it's going to abduct the humerus. All right. So what about, how come I don't see any actions? Why not any actions here? What happened? Abducts the arm. Oh, our avatar is gone, but at least I can say, right, it's going to abduct the arm. If I click on this, what would you expect to see? Let's put the deltoid back there. What, does it move? Oh, the avatar came back. Okay, abducts, right? And if you want to replay that motion, I don't have a slider here. You can replay the motion, abduction, right? That's the job of that deltoid. Okay, so I want to go back. Right. Let's still look at the arm. All right, so here is, let's see. Okay, what motion is this? This is a really hard one to remember. All right, so I'm gonna move my arm, and I'm going to move my arm this way. Okay, you see that as flexion? Always think of the hip. This is flexion for sure. All right, so we got flexion, and what's the antagonistic motion? Extension. Okay, so let's look at the muscles that are involved with flexion and flexion and extension. And immediately you should think of, if we want to find antagonistic muscles, you should think of opposite body compartments, right? So eventually you're going to get to opposite body compartments. And let's look at the pectoralis major. Okay, pectoralis major. And it's a superficial muscle. It's right here. We don't have to get rid of a whole bunch of muscles, but here's pectoralis major. We can look at the origin and insertion, get rid of everything. So the origin is what? A little bit of the clavicle, the sternum, a little bit of this rib. The insertion, right, is this tubercle, the greater tubercle. Actually, it's almost right in the intertubercular groove. Right? And so when that muscle contracts, especially these superior parts, that's going to pull the humerus superiorly, and it's going to rotate because the shoulder joint can, right, can undergo circumflexion, which is all those different motions. All right, so let's put maybe the pectoralis back. Let's see if we can find the motion someplace. Okay, flexes the arm at the shoulder. Ah, thank goodness. That's exactly what it does, right? Because this part over here is pulling on that greater tubercle, and that's going to flex the arm. Okay, it has some other functions, right? Because of this broad origin and this insertion, you could also think, well, it's going to pull the humerus toward midline, right, as well. So muscles can have multiple actions. On a practicum, you only have to pick one, so pick what your favorite action would be. I like to think of flexion of the shoulder for the pectoralis. All right. But can you see why it would adduct? Okay, let's put it into motion. Ah, yeah. All right, so the deltoid and pectoralis major are antagonistic to each other, right? One abducts and the other adducts. One pulls the arm closer in, the other pulls it farther away from your body. All right. We started this by looking at flexion of the pectoralis major. Well, where would we find an antagonist for flexion of the pectoralis? Opposite or your back, right? Your posterior thorax. And so then you kind of have to know what muscles are in the posterior thorax. And let's see if I can find it. Oh, yeah, I found it right here. Latissimus dorsi. It's almost going to look like the pectoralis major, except it's a little bit bigger. All right, so here we are, posterior view here. What do we call all these muscles here? I wanted you to know, this whole group. Erector spinae, right? Don't look at all the little subdivisions. All right, so here is the superficial muscle, posterior thorax, and that is the latissimus dorsi. So that is behind your body that inserts into the humerus anteriorly. So when it contracts, it's going to pull the humerus back down. We call that extension. All right, so let's look at origins and insertions. All right, that's really not. Here's the insertion. It almost is the exact same point as the insertion for the pectoralis major. And I think you notice that with the sternocleidomastoid and the splenius muscles, the insertion is the mastoid process. It's exact same insertion, but the origin is on opposite sides of the body. All right, so what motion are we looking for? Well, we want to counteract something of flexion, so we want to look for extension. Extends the arm. Let's see what happens. Yeah, a little avatar, that is extension, right? And if the elbow continues going back, that would be hyperextension. And just like the pectoralis is also important for adduction, remember it was important for adduction, so is the latissimus dorsi. Okay, so here is something strange. Two muscles can be antagonistic to each other in a motion like flexion and extension between the pectoralis and latissimus dorsi. Sometimes, depending on their arrangement, they can actually be synergists in a different motion, like adduction. All right, so let me go back, origin and insertion. Let's put a little bit of a latissimus dorsi right here. All right, so here's the origin. That's not going to move. The insertion is a greater tubercle. So when this muscle contracts, right, it is going to pull the humerus closer to midline, just like the pectoralis major did. So this is a really handy website to where you can see these individual muscles. You can practice naming. You can know something about the origin and insertion and then look at the motion as well. And then maybe you could even do the motion on your own body to help reinforce what you see and what you read there in the text file. All right, so let's look at some other antagonistic muscles. What muscle would you like to look at right now for antagonism? Do you have any kind of muscles that you're kind of interested in learning something about? Okay. Well, let's stay with the arm. Okay. Let's look at triceps and biceps. They're antagonistic. They're in two opposite body compartments. So here's that biceps. Right. And remember, biceps has how many origins? It's in the name. Yeah, it has two origins. Okay. So here I see a nice bicep. So there's that pectoralis we just got done talking about. Let's get rid of some of these other muscles so that I can only see the biceps brachii. Nice. All right, so here is one origin that's right on the tubercle superior to the glenoid fossa. So that's the supraglenoid tubercle. The other origin is on the coracoid process of the scapula. And that comes all the way down across the elbow. Right, inserts into the radial tuberosity. Right, you recognize that as the radius bone right here. Is there enough detail for you to see that? Okay, so if you just want to look at origin and insertions, click on that and you can see them really nicely. If you want to look at the motion, right, flexes the arm. That's at the shoulder. I didn't want to see at the shoulder. I want to see at the elbow right here. Oh, you know where we would have to look? We would have to look at motions of the forearm, not the humerus. Let's check that out. So let's go back. Muscles that act on the forearm, which means that something's going to happen here at the elbow. What do we got? Biceps brachii. Nice. Let's turn this around. Here's that biceps brachii. Let's get rid of all these other muscles so that we're only left with the biceps. Nice. When it contracts, right, it flexes. Right, it flexes the elbow. There we go. Flexion. So where would we look for a muscle that is going to extend at the elbow or extend the forearm? Yeah, posterior arm. So let's go back. Do we have something there? Ah, triceps brachii. Oh, it's got three heads. Which one do we want to pick? I don't know. Let's pick this one, the long head. So if you want to visualize all these different heads, go ahead and do your little virtual dissection. Don't let that little cursor run away too far. Grab it. Okay, so here is the long head. And I'm confusing you. Okay. This one is for flexion and extension at the shoulder. It doesn't go across the elbow. Right? So this one is not for extending at... Yeah, it is, because here's the olecranon process on the ulna. Right? So when this muscle contracts, it's going to pull the olecranon process superiorly, and that's going to cause extension of the forearm. So here's that triceps attached across the elbow, and when it contracts, it causes extension, like so. All right, the other things that you don't have to know for lab or in lecture is the innervation. You don't have to know the nerves that go to these different muscles. Okay. Okay, what's another antagonistic pair that we would like to look at? How about, let's go to the leg, someplace in the leg, muscle system. Muscles that, you can also do this little quiz right here. I don't have that for you to do specifically, but it wouldn't be a waste of time for you to do that little quiz. Muscles that act on the thigh. Let's look at muscles that act on the leg. Right, muscles that act on the leg are going to be in the thigh. Remember, where is your leg once again? Between what two joints? Your leg is between your knee and your ankle. All right, so that's the thing that's going to move. The muscles that cause that thing to move are in your thigh. All right, so muscles that act on the leg. Let's look here. So here, okay, I don't see much of the thigh. Okay, I do see the leg over here. Well, let's look in the anterior thigh. Anterior thigh has a group of muscles called the quadriceps. So it has four parts. Rectus femoris is one, and then vastus lateralis, vastus medialis, and vastus intermedius are the other three parts to it. So let's just look at the rectus femoris. Now we're back at the thigh. This makes good sense. All right, let's get a bunch of these other muscles out of here. All right, so here is the rectus femoris, right? And so I can see the insertion is way down here on the tibial tuberosity via the ligament of the quadriceps, the tendon of the quadriceps attached to the patella. So it's going to pull this part of the tibia anteriorly. So what happens when this muscle contracts? It's going to produce the kicking motion. All right, so the rectus femoris is on what side of the thigh? Anterior or posterior? Anterior, that's right. So where would you look for an antagonistic muscle? Yeah, the posterior thigh. So let's look if I can find something over there. All right, so it would be the same for all of these other parts of the quadricep muscles. Well, I know that these three muscles are in the posterior compartment. These are what we call the hamstrings. There are three of them. And let's maybe look at the semimembranosus. Nice. Grab the little cursor. Okay, I see a lot of, you don't have to remember all of these muscles, right? But now I see the hamstrings right here, at least a couple of the muscles of the hamstrings, and I selected semimembranosus, which is the big medial muscle. Let's get rid of all the rest of these. All right, so what about the insertion? Okay, it's going to be on the tibia, right, just like the rectus femoris was, but not on the anterior side, but the posterior side. And when it contracts, right, it's going to flex at the knee or flex the leg. Indeed, it does. All right, so antagonistic pair of the forearm was biceps and triceps. The antagonistic pair of the leg is the quadriceps and hamstrings. Or you could pick any one of these muscles, like semimembranosus or semitendinosus. So if we want to pick a different muscle, I think we got to go back one, like semitendinosus. All right, so here is the semitendinosus. Notice that it's very close to semimembranosus, and it also flexes the knee. All of these muscles in the posterior thigh are going to be antagonistic to all of the muscles in the anterior thigh. Okay, let's look at the thigh. Let's look across the hip. What muscles are used across the hip? Let's see what we have right here. Muscle tutorials. Forearm, thigh, leg, ankle, back, neck, head, abdomen. Act on the thigh. Okay. Okay, so here's posterior thigh. Let's look at gluteus maximus. Gluteus maximus is a big muscle, the most superficial one. And we don't have to get rid of many muscles to see it because it is superficial. But if we just want to look at it by itself, just to be really clear, right, we can dissect away some of these muscles. And so you see that the origin is on the ilium, the posterior surface of the ilium, and the insertion is, well, some pieces that we didn't really have to know about, right, like the gluteal tuberosity, part of the linea aspera. So when this muscle contracts, it's going to pull the femur posteriorly. And what do we call that? That is increasing the angle, so that is extension. All right, so gluteus maximus, important muscle for extending the thigh. Where would we want to find a muscle that's going to flex the thigh? Okay, so the gluteus is posterior, so we're going to look anterior. And this one is a little bit more obscure. You're going to be familiar with it in lab. It's called the iliopsoas muscle. And so here is a pelvis, so here's the iliac fossa, so this is the anterior side of the ilium. And then here is the iliopsoas muscle. Iliopsoas is made up of two different muscles, the psoas major and the iliacus. So let's maybe just look at the iliacus first, and we'll get rid of a whole bunch of these other muscles. All right, so what was our goal? Our goal was to find something, right, in the anterior thigh. How did we do? Did we find something anterior? Yeah, it's anterior to the ilium, and the gluteus maximus was what? Posterior. All right, you can look at the origins and insertions, all right, or you can just look at the action. So flexion, does it flex at the hip? What was that? Is this flexion? Indeed it is. And remember, what did we do with the gluteus? We extended, right? Opposite body compartments. So you can check that motion. Go ahead, do it yourself, right? If you want to palpate, see what muscles are working, that's fine. But you know what? You can't palpate these because they're deep inside your abdominal cavity, right? Gluteus maximus, you can. Okay, some antagonistic pairs. Okay, so a lot of times people like to exercise their abdominal muscles by doing sit-ups. Right, can you picture doing a sit-up? Like sit on the floor, then lie down on the floor, and then just kind of sit up like that and the stomach muscles contract. That makes the stomach muscles. Right, but what other motion are, and when you contract those abdominal muscles, what is moving on your body? What part of your skeleton is moving when abdominal muscles contract? Yeah, your vertebral column, right? So abdominal muscles, when you flex the vertebral column, that's a good exercise. But when some people do a sit-up, they actually sit up all the way. So not only are they flexing their vertebral column, but what other joint are they moving? their hip, right, when they sit up. All right, so when they do a, when you do a sit-up all the way up, you're not exercising the abdominal muscles as much as you are exercising the flexor of the hip, which is the iliopsoas. So a lot of times when somebody's interested in developing musculature, you like to focus or isolate on a muscle group. Right, so when you do a sit-up to strengthen your abdominal muscles, what should that motion be? Should you sit up? Should you sit up all the way? No, you should just flex your vertebral column. Right? No sense flexing at the hip because that's not isolating abdominal muscles. That's now also exercising the psoas, iliopsoas muscle. That's important for flexing of the hip. Okay, just to relate. Something that you might be a little bit familiar with already. Let's look at plantar flexion and dorsiflexion muscles for that. Alright, so let's go back. Plantar flexion, do you agree that those are antagonistic motions? Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Alright, let's go back to muscle men. So what do we want to look at here? Muscles that act on the thigh? No. Leg? No. Ankle and foot? That sounds good. I think we want to look at this area right here. Okay, because here I see a foot, ankle. And let's look at a muscle that is important for dorsiflexion, which is what kind of motion? Lifting your toes up off the ground. All right, so here's the tibialis anterior, nicely named because it's on the anterior side of the tibia, right, and it goes all the way across your ankle. And it dorsiflexes, indeed. Is that dorsiflexion? Okay, for sure that's dorsiflexion. Where would you look to find plantar flexors? Instead of the anterior leg, you want to go to the posterior leg. So let's see if we can find something in the posterior leg. There are two important muscles there. And remember, we said those muscles have to be stronger because when you plantar flex, you have to lift your whole body off the ground, not just the tip of your toes. All right, so let's find that gastrocnemius. Ah, is that what I clicked? I hope I clicked gastrocnemius. Ah, it came back. Okay, gastrocnemius. All right, so again, it has two heads, and it inserts into the calcaneus. Here's the calcaneus. You had to know that for one of your tarsal bones. That's your heel bone. So when this big, powerful muscle contracts, it elevates this rear portion, the posterior portion of the calcaneus. Right, which then rotates your ankle and produces plantar flexion. All right, so let's look at this motion over here, plantar flexion. Indeed, gastrocnemius. So gastrocnemius is going to be antagonistic to which muscle? The anterior, yeah, which is the tibialis anterior or anterior tibialis. I don't care what you call it. Either one of those is fine. All right, but there's another muscle that is underneath the gastrocnemius that you have to know something about, and it's called the soleus. So on this illustration right here, I can see actually both of them. I see what is this muscle right here? We just got done talking about this. This is the gastrocnemius. And you see this one tucked underneath it here and here. I just see a little bit of an edge to it. That is the soleus, right? So it's deep to the gastrocnemius. Let's see if we can isolate that one. Let's get the gastrocnemius out of the way. Nice, we got it out of the way. And here it is. Right, gastrocnemius is going to be on top of it. And I said this was a synergist to the gastrocnemius, which means what about the insertion? Should the insertion be vastly different or the same? Yeah, it should be the same, right? Like the splenius and sternocleidomastoid. All right, so here is the insertion of the soleus. Again, it is the calcaneus. And the soleus is attached to this tendon right here, and this is the same tendon that the gastrocnemius is attached to. And so sometimes it's called the calcaneal tendon, sometimes it's called the Achilles tendon from Greek mythology. Right? So if this tendon ruptures, what motion does a person lose at this ankle right here? It can't plantar flex, right? You can't plantar flex. You can only dorsiflex, so you lose a lot of control of your ankle. That's a pretty common injury. Right, when you have a rupture of the Achilles tendon, unfortunately, probably very painful. Right, and so does contraction of the soleus cause plantar flexion? You would have to say yes, right? Plantar flexion, indeed. Right, so soleus and gastrocnemius are synergists, right? And which one would you guess is the prime mover? It would be the bigger of the two. And so I would probably guess gastrocnemius would be the prime mover. And what would be antagonistic to both the soleus and gastrocnemius? Yeah, the tibialis anterior. Okay. All right, so I've kind of really beat to death opposite body compartments and antagonistic motion, and that was in your list right when we first started looking at muscles. So I think somebody asked me, should I memorize that list of actions and what body compartment? That's probably a really good idea, right? Because you can just flip to the right answer very quickly when you do that. I didn't talk about muscles of respiration. So pay pretty close attention to some muscles of respiration. I'll just say really quick. Okay. Inspiration mostly is due to the diaphragm. And you know where the diaphragm is, separates thoracic from abdominal cavity. When it contracts, it makes the thoracic cavity larger. Right, here are some other muscles important for respiration. Muscles between your ribs, those are intercostals. And it just so happens that the external intercostals, when they contract, elevate the rib cage, making the thorax bigger, right? Just like the diaphragm. Diaphragm makes the thorax bigger when it contracts. So external intercostals are synergistic to the diaphragm, right? And remember, diaphragm is for inspiration, so external intercostal is for inspiration. Right? That's not how it was named. It was named because it's the superficial muscle in this group, external. The internal intercostals, you can see, are oriented the opposite way. When they contract, they compress the thorax, and you exhale. Right? So external and internal intercostals are antagonistic to each other. They're not exactly opposite body compartments, but they're on opposite sides of the wall of the thorax. So internal intercostals for expiration, external intercostals for inspiration. Maybe you should just say that a couple times because it doesn't match up exactly, right? Internals are not for inspiration. Externals are not for expiration. It's the other way around, okay? All right, so just pay a little bit of attention to that. External for inspiration. Internal for expiration, right? Yes, so external for inspiration. Externals are synergist with the diaphragm. The internals are antagonistic. Okay. Okay. So that's it before the test. Wow, I better find that test.